Ches and Chagiga, don't forget. Second part. Second half of the book. Thank you. Okay, five lines from the end of the page. The Gemara was discussing at great length this whole story about Yom Tavuch, the day after Sukkot. The day after Shavuos. The Gemara was discussing where do we learn it out from. And all the thank you, and all the various different sources of it. Right, Matzliach. Okay, so now it says the last thing the Gemara said it was a Chol HaMoed was given up to the Chachamim to decide which malachas are allowed, which malachas not allowed. So now the Gemara says again, five lines from the end of the page. Umetarim behesped of Itainis, the Mishnah said that the day after Shavuos, Yom Tavuach, you're allowed to have eulogies, and you're allowed to fast. Why? Shalalakayim es divrei ha'omim, not to uphold the words of those that don't believe in the oral tradition, to say that Atzeres is Acher HaShabbos, that Atzeres is always on Sunday. This we learned in the Mishnah before, and what it means is as follows. The Pasuk, when it speaks about counting the Omer, that we count on the second day of Pesach. So the Gemara, the Torah uses the expression, Usfarto Nochem Mimochras HaShabbos. You should count from the day after Shabbos. Now the rabbis interpreted Shabbos to mean Yom Tov, the holiday. Meaning the second day of Pesach, you begin counting the Omer. The people that took the written Torah literally, they didn't believe in the oral tradition. So they said, when the Torah says, you start counting from the day after Shabbos, so they said, you always start counting on Shabbos. If you always start counting on, the day after Shabbos, Sunday. So according to them, you started counting the Omer always Saturday night. If you count 50 days, the 50th day will always be on Sunday. So according to them, Shavuos is always on Sunday. So the Chachamim wanted to show that the Tzedukim were wrong. So they said that on the day after Shavuos, you're allowed to fast, you're allowed to eulogize, and so on and so forth. So the Gemara asks a question. What? We'll soon see in the Gemara. So the Gemara asks, but how can you say such a thing? Or Vatanya, we learned, Maisa, there's a story. Umeis Alexa Balud, this person Alexa, was a prominent person, died in Lud. And all the Jews entered to eulogize him. And Reb Tarfon did not allow them to eulogize him, because it was Shavuos. That's the simple meaning of the Gemara. It says this person died, and the people wanted to eulogize him, and Reb Tarfon said, "You can't because it's Shavuos." So the Gemara asked right away, "Yom Tov Salka Daitach? What do you mean Yom Tov? You can't make funerals on Yom Tov." Did all the Jews come to eulogize him? Of course not. You can't come to eulogize a person on Yom Tov. What it means is, it was the day following Shavuos. It wasn't Shavuos, it was the day after Shavuos. And they thought that you're allowed to eulogize somebody after Shavuos. And Reb Tarfon stopped them. That you're not allowed to eulogize somebody. So the Gemara asks, but our Mishnah says you are allowed to eulogize on the day after Shavuos. So what's the problem? Why does Reb Tarfon say you can't if our Mishnah says you could? So the Gemara says, Loi Kashi, it's not a problem. Kam b'yom tev shechol yisachar ha-Shabbos. One case is speaking when Shavuos fell out on Sunday. Kan b'yom tev shechol yis b'Shabbos. One case is speaking when the Yom Tov fell out on Shabbos itself, and one case is speaking when it fell out on Sunday. What does this mean? The Mishnah says you're allowed to eulogize somebody when Shavuos falls out on Sunday. The day after Shavuos falls out on Sunday. Because to show that the Tzedukim were so wrong that it has no connection to Sunday whatsoever. So the Chachamim said you can eulogize somebody on that day. But normally, if Shavuos, let's say, falls out on Tuesday, and the Yom Tavuach, the slaughtering day, is Wednesday, everybody says you can't make eulogies. When did the Chachamim permit a eulogy? Only when it was on Sunday. To show that the Tzedukim, who maintained Shavuos, was always on Sunday, and therefore you're not allowed to eulogize, the Chachamim said, if it's the case of Sunday, then you could eulogize on Sunday. Just to show that Shavuos is not on Sunday. Unless, if it falls out that way. So this is what the Gemara, what the Mishnah is explaining. Okay, now starts a new Mishnah. Next page. Okay, now the Gemara is going into the laws of purity and non-purity. And let me explain, just to give an introduction to the next piece of Gemara that we should understand. It is something we already learned before, but it was a while ago, so I'm going to explain the concept again. Now we're on 18b1. Okay? But that basically, by the way, 18b1 is only going to be an introduction to the Mishnah. The Mishnah will sell 18. Okay. There is, in Torah, the concept of purity and impurity. Purity and impurity are complete laws of illogic. Why something becomes impure and why something is pure is completely illogical. But in the laws of purity and impurity, there are different categories of purity and impurity. For instance, a dead body itself, the dead body, is called Avi Avei Satuma, the grandfather of impurity, meaning that is the strongest level of impurity that exists.
Human body, right?
Not animal. Human body. An animal body is the next level. A human body, especially of a Jew, is the ultimate level of impurity. You need the red heifer, the ashes of the red heifer. It takes you 7 days to become pure. Okay? Then there's what's called Av HaTumah. Av HaTumah means primary father tumah. What does that mean? If a person touches a dead body, they become what's called Av HaTumah, because they go down a level. They become what's called Av HaTumah, the father of impurity. If they touch somebody, that person becomes what's called a Rishon, first child. If they touch something, it becomes a Sheni. Okay, now, it's going to take a little bit of time to explain this because there's so many different categories of Tumah and how far it extends, and in what issues it extends. The holier the object, the more susceptible it is to become impure. Okay? You have what's called chulin. Chulin is something which is everyday stuff. It's not holy, it's just regular stuff. Then you have the next category of holiness is Maiser Sheni. Maiser Sheni is tithing of your produce, that you have to take 10% of your produce, you have to give it some to a Kohen, certain things you have to give to Kohen, then you take 10% of what's left, you give it to a Levi, then there's what's called Maiser Sheni. Maiser Sheni is, you take 10% of your produce, you eat it in Yerushalayim. You can, it's yours, you own it, you don't have to give it to anybody, you're allowed to eat it, but only in Yerushalayim. What happens if it's too much to carry? You're a rich man, and you have bushels and bushels and tons of tithings. You redeem it for money. The money becomes holy. You take the money to Yerushalayim, you spend it there on food, and you eat it, the stuff in Yerushalayim. Now, it's not holy because everybody could eat it. But it's a little holy because you can only eat it in Yerushalayim. Then there's another category of holiness that's called Truma. Truma is an uplifting that belongs to a Kohen. Only a Kohen could eat it. You have to be a Kohen to eat it. You can't eat it if the Kohen is impure. It's a category of holiness, which is called Truma. Then there's a holier category, and that's called Hekdesh, things that belong to the temple, sacrifices, that's even holier. Then you have the ultimate level of holiness, things that have to do with the red heifer. It's called Chatos, for the Korban Chatos, the ultimate for the red heifer. Okay, so you have everyday stuff, you have Ma'aseh Sheni stuff, you have Truma stuff, you have Hekdesh stuff, and then you have Chatos, which is called Parah Aduma, the red heifer stuff. Now, you have people, it's going to be confusing at the beginning, and trust me, it's going to be confusing, but the more we learn about it, the more it's going to straighten out, and everything will make sense. In order to make a person Tamei, a person could only become Tamei from an Av HaTuma. An Av HaTuma has the ability to make a person Tamei. But if I, let's say, touch the dead body, I become Av HaTuma. If I touch you, you become Tamei. You become what's called a Rishon. If you touch another person, that person cannot become Tamei. If you touch food, it could become Tamei. But not a person. Now, an Av HaTuma is not only somebody who touched a dead body. An Av HaTuma could be a person who has bodily impurities. For instance, a Zov, a man who certain liquids flow from the body, like seed and semen or whatever, they become an Av HaTuma. If they touch a person, that person becomes Tamei. The dead carcass of an animal is an Av HaTuma. It's that category of Tuma that if a person touches it, it becomes Tamei. But if somebody touches an Av HaTuma, they become Tamei, but they cannot make anything else Tamei. Only food. And even with food, they can only go to a Sheni. Meaning, if a person touches, again, we're going to go slow and you'll get it, but it's a little complicated at the beginning. A guy touches a dead body, he becomes Av HaTuma. You give Shalom Aleichem to another Jew, he becomes a Rishon. Okay? He becomes impure. But if he touches another guy, that other guy does not become Tamei. But if he touches food, the food becomes a Sheni. And with everyday stuff, Chulin, Tuma does not go past Sheni. That means if a Sheni touches something else, another piece of food, that's not Truma and not Hekdesh enough, it does not become Tamei.
What if it is Truma
and Hekdesh? Truma goes to Shlishi, Hekdesh goes to Revi, and Paraduma goes to Chamishi. Whoa. Because it's holier, it can take, and the Torah is stricter. What?
Do any of these apply today without having the Beit HaMikdash in existence?
No. I'll give you an example. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, a woman, during her menstrual cycle, when she was a Nida, and Nida is an Av HaTuma. Now, therefore a woman who was a Nida was not allowed to eat sacrifices. She was not allowed to go into the temple.
She couldn't wash her dishes.
Make
1 minute. So, if Anida touched a friend of hers, that lady became Tamei. Right? So therefore, that lady couldn't eat sacrifices. She couldn't go into the Beis HaMikdash. So in the time of the temple, when a woman, believe it or not, was Anida, she had special garments that she wore that everybody should know she's Anida. Why? Because if somebody touched her, even by mistake, that person became Tamei, they wouldn't be allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash or eat sacrifices. So everybody had to know. Today, it's completely irrelevant. Because we're all Tamei. And there are no sacrifices, and there's no Beis HaMikdash to go into. The only law of purity and impurity that applies today is a kohen cannot become tameh, a kohen cannot touch a dead body, a kohen cannot go to a cemetery, a kohen cannot be in the same room with a dead body. That's it. The only concept of impurity that exists that the Gemara says, Chayiv Adam Latayra Satmi Beregel, that before Chag, a person should go to the mikveh to purify themselves. But again, it doesn't have any relevance in practical halacha because we're all tamei. That's why you can give somebody Shalom Aleichem even though guy works in a mortuary. I mean, it doesn't matter.
What about the woman in need and the husband? What category is that? Now.
That's tumah. But again, that level of tumah is impurity that a husband cannot be with his wife when she's in nida until she goes to the mikvah. But that's it. But again, as far as everybody else is concerned, there's no concept of impurity as far as hegdish or chulin or mice or anything. We'll learn soon in the Gemara, one of the reasons we wash our hands for bread has to do with the laws of impurity. Now, one more important thing to keep in mind, and again, all these things we're going to relearn and it's going to get clearer as we go on. Biblically, if a person becomes tameh, the whole body becomes tameh. If your foot touched something impure, your whole body became impure. If your hand touched something impure, your whole body becomes impure. There's no such thing biblically, part of you becomes impure and part of you doesn't. By rabbinic impurities, sometimes the Chachamim said, parts of your body become tameh, like your hands. In fact, the concept of people, and again, it's not real, we're going to see more of this in the Gemara later. The laws of washing your hands before davening, or before bread, you know, or things like that, is not so much tumah, even though washing for bread is connected to the concept of impurity, but only the hands become tameh, and therefore you only have to wash your hands. You don't have to wash your whole body. But biblically, any biblical impurity impurifies the entire body. There's no such thing as a partial impurity. Sometimes, even if you don't touch a dead body, you're in the same, remember we learned, if you're in the same room, under the same roof as a dead body, you become impure, even though you didn't even touch him. Now, when a person becomes impure, as a rule, they go to the mikveh, but they don't become completely pure until sundown, or nightfall. V'tamei ad ha'erev, the Torah says you become tamei, you remain tamei until evening. So these basically is what the concept of the impurity that the Mishnah is going to be discussing now. When do you wash your hands? But the Mishnah obviously is only speaking about rabbinic impurities that the Chachamim say only go onto the hands of the person and nothing else. But biblical impurities make the entire person tummy.
Are there still the food, is there still tumah that's applicable to food? Like for women's anita?
Nowadays, it's completely irrelevant.
So any of the
tumah. Again, if a woman who's anita makes food, in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, she had a problem eating it.
Today it's irrelevant.
Today it's completely irrelevant. So again, we're going to see the various different categories of tumah and the purification of tumah, and not only are there different levels of impurity, but there are different levels of what could become impure. Like everyday stuff, chulin can only go to sheni, the second level. That's it. Truma goes even to a shlishi. That means if a sheni object touches chulin, it does not become tameh. If he touches truma, it's going to become tameh. If a shlishi touches truma, it's not going to become tummy. But if a shlishi touches hegdish, it is going to become tummy.
Hegdish
as sacrifices or object, things that belong to the Beis HaMikdash. There's all, okay, we're going to see the other concepts of Tumas Yadayim and so on. Okay, so now the Mishnah says the following din. Neitan and Yud Ches Amid Beis. Or, 36. Top of the page. No, he's in the wrong Gemara. To go to the second part. Okay, it says now, Neitan Liyadayim. You have to wash only your hands. L'chulin, for chulin means for everyday stuff. For ma'aser sheni, and for truma, meaning if a person wants to eat any of these types of foods, even if we don't know he's tummy, he's not even tummy. You have to wash your hands with a vessel to remove the impurity from the hands. Meaning, the Chachamim came along and said as follows. There's a rule, and this, by the way, this rule is practical in today's world. There's a rule in Halacha that says, Yodayim askan yasein. A person's hands are always busy. The hands are always touching and doing. You don't know what you're touching. So the Chachamim said, we can assume rabbinically that your hands touch something which is some type of impurity. So therefore, before you eat food, you have to remove the impurity from your hands. Because it's only on the hands. Why is it only on the hands? Because your hands are always moving. Your feet don't always move into everything. Your hands always get into everything. But that's why we're talking about it's only rabbinic. We're not talking about something that... The guy didn't even know he touched anything. The Chachamim came along and said, because your hands are always active, we have a rabbinic assumption that your hands are impure. And I'll give you another example, and just to show how strange these laws are, so to speak, and they're completely illogical. They don't make sense in any way whatsoever. You know, when you wake up in the morning, okay, you have to watch what's called Negel Vasser. Negel Vasser, by the way, is Yiddish. Negel is the nails, the fingernails. And Vasser is water. What's Negel Vasser? Negel Vasser is you wash your fingernails. That's the simple meaning of the word Negel Vasser. Now, why do you wash Negel Vasser in the morning? And by the way, this only applies to Jews. Goyim don't have to wash Negel Vasser. Why do you have to wash Negel Vasser in the morning? Because at night, when you go to sleep, your soul leaves the body, goes up to heaven. As the Gemara says, sleep is the 60th of death. Then you wake up in the morning, the neshama comes back, the impurity leaves. But it still stays on the fingertips. The impurity of the night that set in when holiness leaves. So then, how do you get off the impurity in the morning? You get up, the first thing you do is you wash your hands. Washing of the hands removes the impurity from the night.
On your fingertips?
Technically, it's the fingertips. Lachatchila, I mean, b'diavad, you could go from the knuckles because that's the fingers. The custom is to wash properly until the wrist. But technically, like on Yom Kippur, Tisha B'Av, you only wash until the knuckles. Because that is really where the tumah is, the impurity of the night, only goes on the fingertips. And it says you have to be very careful, you shouldn't touch parts of your body that are normally covered before you wash your hands, you're not supposed to touch food, because there's a ruach ra, there's this impure spirit on your fingertips. Goyim, by the way, don't have to wash negel vasser. If you have a housekeeper, they can prepare your food, even though they don't wash negel vasser. I had a question, why don't they have this ruach ra that's on your fingertips that we're very careful not to touch food without washing the negel vasser? So the answer is very simple. Impurity sets in where holiness existed and left. Where holiness existed and left, that's where impurity comes in. But if there was never holiness to begin with, impurity doesn't set in there. So because the Jew has a neshama which is holy, and that neshama leaves when you go to sleep, so impurity comes in. So you want to get rid of it, you have to wash your hands. By goyim, it doesn't apply. But how, one second, how do they, so their hands don't become impure? They could touch your food without having to wash nagel vaser in the morning. How does the impurity of the night go off? By washing your hands, alternatively, you got the point. One, that's the way you alternate your hands. That's the way the tumor comes off. Washing for bread is a different way. Washing for bread is one, two, or we do three, three. We don't wash alternate. What?
People that don't know this and they don't do it this way, so what's their status as far as touching and things? It's a
good point, but the point is people wash their hands in the morning, and when you turn on the faucet, the first gush that comes out is considered as if you poured it. I'll give you, you know, that in the matzah bakeries where they make the hand shmur matzah, all the ladies are coming, they don't care if they're religious, non-religious, the women that in Yiddish called valgering the dough, they roll the dough into the matzah, yeah? They make them, when they come in the morning, they're all Jewish women, not all of them are religious, they make them all wash nagel vaser before they start working. They don't want them touching the dough before, the whole thing in the bakeries, you know, you have the ladies that work in the bakeries, they're not always religious. The question, they touch, you ask for a loaf of bread, they take the bread and they cut it, and then, or they take you a Danish. So what, some people have a problem with it. But the truth is, other people say, listen, everybody washes their hands in the morning, so passably, whatever they did is probably good enough, in a passable way, to remove the impurity. So that's not a problem. What?
Water next to bed, that's the first thing they do. I heard that the water becomes tumma itself.
If the water is underneath the bed, it becomes impure. If you put your negavas underneath your bed, so when you sleep over it, anything under the bed becomes impure. Or, if you, I wouldn't say sleepwalk, but if you hand walk in your sleep, what happens in the middle of the night or before you want to wash your hands, you stick your hands into the water, that water becomes impure. You can't use it to wash. Because you put your impure hands into the water, so the water...
So when you're holding the cup, you can't...
Well, right. You're supposed to... Let's get back to the Gemara. So the Mishnah says as follows. You have to wash your hands... Meaning, before involvement in any of these types of foods, whether you're tummy or not, the Chachamim said, you have to purify your hands by pouring water over them, whether it's for chulin, whether it's for maisa sheni, like we said, the maisa tait that you eat in your shalayim, or for truma. But lukaydish, but if you want to eat hegdish, then matbilim, you have to put it in the mikveh. You have to put your hand in the mikveh.
Oh, just your hands?
Just your hands.
Whoa.
In other words, well, again, this doesn't apply today because nobody eats korbanos today. We don't have hegdish today. We don't have sacrifices today. But in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, you wanted to eat a korban, the animal of the sacrifice, the meat, you had to put your hand in the mikveh. Now, ulechatos, but when it comes to the chatos, meaning the water mixed with the ashes of the paraduma, it's even stricter. Imnit muyadov, if your hands became tamei, Nit magufa, your whole body must become tamei. Meaning, even though it's only a rabbinic impurity, which normally if it's a rabbinic impurity, only your hands become tamei, but the chachamim were strict that if you're talking about the ashes of the red heifer, so then your whole body becomes tamei, even though it's only rabbinic. So again, there's different classifications. For certain things, it's enough just to wash your hands. For hegdish, you have to put your hand in the mikveh. For chatos, you have to put your whole body in the mikveh.
Oh, good.
What?
I hope it's not anything. But if you go into the mikveh completely, you still have to... Are you technically your hands also okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we wash our hands after mikveh...
If you want to put your hands in a mikveh instead of washing them for bread, it's good. The only question is, what bracha do you make? But that's... Atvilas yadayim, Natilas yadayim. Because Natila means with a keli. When you wash with a vessel, it's called Natila. Tvilas kelim. Tvilas yadayim. Tvilas, you're tabling, you're immersing your hand in the mikveh. What?
So when we wash our hands after going to the mikveh, that's because we're getting dressed, but not because of the mikveh. But people got the mikveh. They wash their hands.
The reason why you wash your hands after the mikveh, because you're dressed, you touch, and not only that, it's a room which people are undressed in. There's certain things, give you an example. It says in Halacha, certain things you have to wash your hands for. I'll give you an example. You cut your nails, you have to wash your hands. You take a haircut, you have to wash your hands. In the old times you used to do bloodletting, you know, let out blood. You go for a blood test, take out blood, you have to wash your hands. The custom is even to go with...
Afterwards.
But in Allah it says, by the way, and a lot of people don't know this, if you just walk into a mikveh room, even though you don't do anything, you just walk in to drop off your towel, you have to wash your hands when you walk out.
What about the showering in your house?
Even if no one's in there?
Even if nobody's in there.
Cause basically
technically, in Allah it says, if you walk into a bathroom, just walking into a bathroom, you have to wash your hands. But today's bathrooms are not like the olden times bathrooms. You know, which were outhouses and everything was still in the room. Here, with everything's flushed away, so you walk into a bathroom, you don't have to wash your hands.
Really?
Halachically not. I'm saying, if you use the bathroom, you do. I'm saying,
right.
If you don't,
just walk into a
just
bathroom,
walk in.
You
if you walk into a mikveh, which is a room, which is designated for people to be undressed, and you have to wash your hands.
Even if there's no one in the mikveh.
Even if nobody in there. What?
I was applied to a shower today also, right?
Correct. If you take a shower, you wash your whole body. Okay. For that matter, I give you a little, you go swimming, when you finish, you have to wash your hands.
The bathroom has a shower.
Basically.
The bathroom has a shower.
Yeah, but it's not, it's a separate, closed off thing with a curtain or with something else.
So when you're swimming.
You're going swimming, you finish swimming, you have to wash your hands. The custom is to go with, you know, a keli. If you go swimming.
But there's no bracha. No
bracha.
If you go swimming.
Bracha is only for bread. Or in the morning when you get up.
But that's like, it's not totally being enclosed. It's just the idea of being in a place where people are.
If it's a room, which is, if you walk on the sand, you don't have to wash your hands.
Or if you lay in the ocean, you do?
If you go swimming, you have to wash your hands.
If you take a shower, you get out of there. Salt.
No, but.
At least you become kosher. You dekashi your flesh with the salt.
If you jump
like
in
chickens.
With your bathing suit into the ocean and come out.
You have to wash your hands.
Why? Just curious.
Because it's a mechatz. If you wash your whole body. Anyway, so this is what the Mishnah says. Now the Mishnah continues with part number two. Technically, if a guy falls into a mikveh, by mistake, he didn't even want to. A friend of his pushed him into the mikveh. He got drenched and fell into the mikveh. He becomes pure. Biblically, you don't need kavana, you don't need intent to purify yourself in the mikveh. The chachamim came along and said, no. You need kavana. Chachamim say, if a guy just fell into the mikveh, it's not good enough. Not only is it not good enough, if you want to eat chulin, everyday stuff, and you immersed in the mikveh with the intent, you want to become pure for chulin, it's not good for meiser. It's not good for truma. If you went to the mikveh and your intention was to become pure for truma, you can't eat hegdish. Even though it's the same immersion, it's the same thing. The Chachamim said, because of all these different stages and classifications, yutevel for chulin, it's not good for meiser. Yutevel for meiser, it's not good for truma. Yutevel for truma. Now, obviously, the stronger one is good for the weaker one. But the weaker one is not good for the stronger one.
Can you have a general intention of
what you're going? No, we're going to see that in the Gemara. We're going to see that in the Mishnah. But it's interesting. The Chachamim came along and said, it's so interesting because what's the difference? You're immersing, it's the same immersion. You know, you're getting your body wet, the whole body in a kosher water, in a kosher mikveh. You know, what's the problem? No. If you only had in mind the weaker, it's not good for the stronger. And then it says, what happens if you had no intention whatsoever?
Not good for anything.
It's not good for anything. Rabbinically. Biblically, it's good for everything. Rabbinically, it's not good for anything. That's what the...
So how does that work?
Huh?
So how does this work?
I mean, how does it work?
I mean, a biblical overrides a rabbinical, doesn't it?
No, the Rabbanan are stricter.
Right, but if as long as there's not a...
Only a positive, right?
No, the Chachamim were stricter. The Chachamim could come along and say, biblically you're pure, and we're saying you're still impure.
Positive, right?
No, they can do it negative. I mean, either ones. They can't, well, they could be stricter in negative commandments too. I'll give you a simple example. The Torah says, don't eat meat and milk together. Yeah? The Chachamim came along and said, you can't eat chicken and milk either. It's a negative commandment, and they were stricter in the negative command. Biblically, chicken is not meat. Because what does the Torah say? Loi sevashel gedi b'chalevimai. You can't cook a goat in its mother's milk.
I meant they can't. One
second, but chickens have no milk.
And an egg is kosher.
Right? So chicken, technically, biblically, is not meat. The Chachamim said, it's meat and you can't eat it with milk either. And if you do, by the way, you get rabbinically lashes.
Did people, Rabbanim said that they used to eat meat?
The question, what stage in history did it begin? But technically, in biblical terms, in biblical times, they were allowed to eat chicken and meat. And milk. Because the Torah doesn't say, the Torah says you can't eat a goat in its mother's, cooked in its mother's milk.
Well, I meant that you can't undo.
They can't undo negative commandments. The Chachamim have the power to undo positive commandments. Meaning the Chachamim have no authority to say, do something that the Torah says you're not allowed to do. Like the rabbis can't come along and say, eat treif. They have the authority, biblical authority, to say, the Torah says, blow shofar. We say, don't. The Torah says, do lulav and esrig, we say no. The Gelunt, you know, Rosh Hashanah falls on a Shabbos. Biblically, you have to blow shofar. The Chacham have the power to say don't.
So how does it apply today?
How does it apply today? It doesn't apply because...
So we don't need any special intention to go to the mikvah today.
Right. In fact, the Mefarshim discuss that technically, to eat chulin, the everyday stuff, you know, the regular stuff, the non-holy stuff, you could eat it if you're tamei. It's like, the Mishnah is discussing, if I went to the mikveh for chulin, it's not good for truma. So the commentator, but you don't have to go to the mikveh for chulin. You can eat it even if you're tamei. So the Gemara is discussing, the Mishnah explains, that this refers to super religious people that ate even chulin only when they were pure. So it says, if you're such a guy, you don't have to, but if you're such a guy that eats chulin only when you're pure, if you went to the mikveh for chulin, it's not good for truma. There's absolutely nothing wrong for a Talmudic person to eat an apple. If the apple is truma and you eat it, you get killed. That's death penalty. No, I mean, whatever.
But is truma, we don't have it here, but in Israel we have these problems with truma and like this.
Well, they have to separate, but they throw it out.
I mean, that's why they have like hechshers in supermarkets for fruit.
In America, fruits and vegetables are the least of the problems in kashrus. In Israel, it's a bigger problem than the meat. Because over there, you have to know, was it tithe, was it not tithe, was it trumah, was it shmita, is it orla, you know, everything together. In Israel, you need bigger supervision on fruits and vegetables than you do. In America, you don't need, and raw fruits and vegetables, you don't need any hechsher in America.
It comes to, from Israel.
If it comes from Eretz Yisrael, it's a problem.
We don't even know today.
If you have Jaffa oranges, you have to tithe them. If you buy in the store, if it says product of Israel, you know, whatever the fruits of it, you have to do a whole process.
Sometimes have the
if it has a good, reliable hechsher, it's not a problem. If you buy Israeli jam, right, you could buy Israeli jam, you could buy Israeli pickles, you could buy, I mean, anything that grows. Yeah, and they sell them all over the place. So if it doesn't have a good hechsher, you have a problem not only of kashrus, you have a problem of all the tithings and separations and arlon and everything else that goes along with it.
What would that be your responsibility, though?
You can't eat it.
Well,
if it wasn't tithe, you can't eat it.
You have to give 10%. Right?
Yeah, but if you don't, you can't eat it.
The producer, though.
No. It's only on the producer.
The responsibility falls on the producer, I thought.
No. The responsibility falls on the person who wants to eat it. They can only eat something which was tithed. Now, the Gemara says, scholars and religious people, the day they got the stuff, they already did it. You know, because they didn't want anybody, God forbid, to eat something on their head. But otherwise, of course, it's a big problem. So the Mishnah is discussing, let's just see it inside. Tava l'chulin, if somebody immersed himself, the Mishnah says, it's the third line of the Mishnah. Huchzek l'chulin, he's only pure for chulin, but also l'maiser. He can't eat maiser sheni, because it's a higher category. Tava l'maiser, if a guy immersed only with the intent of for maiser, huchzek l'maiser, he's only pure for maiser, but also l'trum, he cannot eat truma. Tava l'truma, if he tabled for truma, huchzek l'truma, he can only eat truma, but also l'kaidish, he cannot eat hegdish. Tava l'kaidish, what happens if he immersed for hegdish? Huchzek l'hegdish, he's only good for hegdish, but also l'chatis, he's prohibited from handling the paraduma water. And the Mishnah explains, tava, basic, what's the rule? Tava l'chamor, if he immersed for the stricter one, he's good for the lesser one. Tavol, but the other way, not. What happens? Tavol v'le huchzik, a guy immersed without any intent. Ki'ilu le tavol, he never. It's considered as if he didn't tavol. It's considered as if he didn't immerse. Okay.